Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Renee Gerlich. She's a feminist anarchist from New Zealand whose writing appears on her blog, ReneeLG.net, as well as Feminist Current, Savage Minds, and the 2021 anthology Spinning and Weaving. Her talk, Transgenderism, Neoliberalism, and Rape Culture, can be found on YouTube. Visit DragonCloudPress.com. DragonCloudPress.com for a recently published Brief Complete Herstory series, an illustrated history of the world from the Big Bang to neoliberalism. So first off, thank you for being on the program. And second, thank you for your work in the world.
Thank you so much, Derek. I'm really looking forward to speaking with you.
Well, it's always great to talk to you too. let's start by talking about your new series. So what is it? It's a series. What is it? And how did it come about? And what's it do?
So my new series is called A Brief Complete History, which sounds like a contradiction. But it is 7 illustrated books, and they're all quite brief. So they're all less than 30 pages. But they're A4, kind of like a magazine style, with color paintings. And the point of making this series was to create a continuous narrative of herstory, which is something that I was looking for all my life at some points without knowing what I was looking for, and at other times consciously. I kind of grew up craving like some kind of overview of history that I could connect with and understand, and that wouldn't take me a long time to read, because the point of it, of an overview, is kind of to have a springboard or a launch pad to help you identify the more detailed questions that you want to ask. And so I really wanted to provide that, because I don't really see such a thing in the world for women. There are women who have written comprehensive histories of the world, like Monica Shaw wrote The Great Cosmic Mother, and Marilyn French did a series called A History of Women. But I wanted to make something even less demanding, like something that you could read quite quickly and use as a reference very easily, and that is an even more stylized overview. So that's what I've done, a continuous narrative of the world from the Big Bang to neoliberalism, from a female-centered perspective, which is the perspective that makes the most sense. So, yeah.
This may be a bit pedestrian, but can you go through each book and give us, yes, like 30 seconds or a minute or a minute and a half on, absolutely, each book to give us the overview of your overview?
Yeah, definitely. So the first book is called Mother Earth and Sea, and it starts with the Big Bang, and then it talks about the origins of life on Earth and the sea. And to do that, I use the work of Rachel Carson and her book The Sea Around Us, and I also draw on Monica Shaw's Great Cosmic Mother. So all of my books actually really kind of curate and compile the voices of feminist authors and writers and historians who have helped me arrive at this continuous narrative. So that was part of the joy of writing it, was to be able to put these beautiful voices together. So Rachel Carson is an incredibly poetic writer. So it was lovely to talk about that origins of life through her work as well. And she talks about how the sea is like a womb, and how as land animals emerged from the sea, they had to replicate the life-giving conditions of the sea inside our bodies. And so she talks about how she refers to the womb as a miniature ocean. So that's one example of what, you know, a female-centered history looks like when you go all the way back. And then that book as well has a dual function. So it's a history, but it also functions as a biology primer, which I think is something else that's really needed in the world we live in today. So I don't talk about clownfish, but I do kind of show the evolution of how evolution is tied to reproduction, and how and talk about the evolution of human sexuality and women's bodies. And then book two is called Matriarchy and the Creation of Patriarchy. So it begins in the Neolith. It talks about how the natural way of living for people, for a natural way of human organizing, that we live in matriarchies. People are born out of women. It's really natural to trace our lineage through the mother's line, and also to grow up having a birthright to the land that your mother lives on. So that's, to me, what a matriarchy is. And that book explores the work of Indigenous women talking about the matriarchal cultures that they come from. And it gives examples from around the world. And then it looks at the question of how exactly patriarchy was created. And it does that through the work of Gerda Lerner. So it basically summarizes Gerda Lerner's book, The Creation of Patriarchy, to show both the stages through which patriarchy was created, but in doing that, to also show the different ideas or concepts that you have to accept in order to accept the whole system. And then book three is called God.
Wait.
Sorry.
So yeah. Two things about that. One of them is, and I've just been writing about this recently myself, is that Peggy Reeve Sande came up with, she studied rape cross-culturally and came up with the markers of high rape cultures. Some of them are precisely what you'd expect. If it's highly militarized, it's probably high rape. If women are generally degraded or demeaned, it's probably higher rape. You know, stuff that's pretty obvious. And one of them that was really interesting was, if there's a male creator deity versus a female creator deity or a couple creator deity, then it's probably high rape. That could be a marker of high rape. And I heard that from, actually not from reading Peggy Reeve Sande, but interviewing Judith Herman 20 some years ago. And when I interviewed Judith Herman about it, she said that, and then she commented, you know, it is really counterintuitive to have a male creator deity. And I was at the time, let's say 35 years old, and it had never occurred to me how crazy that was. But the moment she said it, it's like, that's really weird. So I just wanted to throw that in, which you can respond to or not. And then the other thing I wanted to throw in is what you said about matrilineality and how counterintuitive it is to have the king's son gets to rule, in part because we know that the mother is we know that the mother is the mother, and we know that the mother's child is the mother's child, but we don't actually know without genetic testing at this point. But traditionally, the king would never actually know for sure that it was his kid, which is one reason they had to control women's sexuality. It just makes so much more sense. All I'm saying, this whole thing, I could have just summed this up by saying so much of this patriarchy is so counterintuitive. So
absolutely.
Take any of that anywhere you want to go.
Yeah. Well, that makes me want to talk about dualism. And book three of my series actually covers that topic, so that's that's a good place to go. So book three of my series is called God. And so it actually, I mean, you talk about the correlation between male deities and kind of, I guess, then a philosophical system with the frequency of rape. In my books, the emergence of these dualistic or patriarchal philosophies is almost follows rape, because it provides a justification. So it's cyclical. Once you have the justification, obviously, and that becomes culturally pervasive, then it becomes like propaganda. Then, you know, that fuels things. But the way I see it is that matriarchal cultures, the philosophies of matriarchal cultures, are very holistic. And without wanting to idealize which is something I'm prone to do because I'm absolutely in love with the matriarchal cultures that I've read about. It really does seem like they reflect the whole and organic nature of life. Merlin Stone talks about this in her book, in her books, When God Was a Woman and Ancient Mirrors of Womanhood. She talks about how the Great Mother is often expressed through a female symbol or a female deity who is both loving and fierce. And she says that in Western scholarship, this is always represented or discussed as though it's a paradox. Being loving and fierce at the same time is somehow a paradox. But she says it is not a paradox. It's entirely consistent. It's only through a patriarchal dualistic framework that you would see it as a paradox, because in dualism, you know, all of these different aspects of life are fragmented and then placed into a hierarchy. We have, you know, various things like light and the sky and consciousness, and men are at the top of a hierarchy, and dark and earth and unconscious, and women are at the bottom. And then for women, being loving becomes something that is glorified, and being fierce is absolutely stigmatized and sinful and not allowed. And so from that perspective, being loving and fierce at the same time is a paradox. But within a holistic framework, it isn't. You know, like go and watch a mother swan with her cygnets, with her babies, like on a river, and then see what happens if you try and approach her babies. Like, this very peaceful, loving scene will quickly become fierce, and that's absolutely consistent. One book that I really enjoyed reading, which discusses dualism, is Judy Foster's Invisible Women of Prehistory. And she kind of talks about how, because this holistic way of seeing the world is so natural and so intuitive, you can't really just substitute it with a fabricated ideology and expect people to swallow it. So dualism itself is not so much a philosophy in and of itself. It's like a formula that you can apply to existing ways of seeing the world, or philosophies, or spiritualities, it's like a filter, like a like a Snapchat filter. You just put it on the top, and then it renders. It can distort a philosophy so that it becomes dualistic. And so the third book in my series talks about how that happened in Europe, and it uses the work of Maria Gimbutas, who studied the Neolithic cultures of Europe and who found that goddesses like Artemis or like Athena and their associations like the bear and the owl were much, much older than the Greek myths of, you know, Homer and Ovid, which are very patriarchal and absolutely rape-obsessed. And she shows how those patriarchal mythologies took much older goddesses and then distorted these characters into being props in a patriarchal narrative. And then she, you know, Marilyn French also talks about this, how in the process of the creation of patriarchy, which was not instant, like from what I understand, it took, you know, like 2,000 years to get from men naming children after themselves rather than having them named after their mother, up to a fully fledged, you know, state with a military and, you know, rampant agriculture and that. So Marilyn French talks about how in that process, myth cycles reflected the gradual subjugation of women with stories about sky gods battling snakes and battling dragons, like into submission and taming them and so forth. Funnily enough, often those snakes and dragons are immortal. So I like that. But yeah, so a little reflection on dualism but obviously, so those philosophies, those patriarchal philosophies, are still at the basis of the world we live in today. And I think this is something that feminists are really good at pointing out, that a lot of the philosophies that we consciously and unconsciously live with, that form the basis of the the institutions that we live with, the religious institutions, the government, even the laws, the philosophies at the heart of those are still based on a model of domination, which is patriarchal, i.e. based on rape, the quintessential form of violation. So one reason for writing a potted history is to allow us to have an overview that allows us to see the world that we live in today, obviously, and how it's come about, and how then decide how we want to respond to it.
Okay, so you've taken us through book three. Do you want to keep going with this, because I think this is really fascinating?
Ah, great. Yeah, I will. So book three, it talks about dualism, and then it talks about the establishment of the church. And it shows how the idea of original sin, which is important to the Catholic Church, is based on this dualistic formula. So original sin, like we're all somehow polluted and contaminated because we're born out of women, and women are at the bottom of the hierarchy, and not associated with light and divinity and goodness. So then this also leads to things like the witch craze, which was justified by this myth of feminine evil. But the myth of feminine evil that is part and parcel of the church then also enters common law. Again, still the basis of the origin of the legal system that we live with today. And so, yeah, this book ends with the Crusades and also with the colonization of South America. And then the next book, book four, is called Capitalism. It looks at the slave trade. It takes off from where book three left off, colonization in North America. And it also looks at how the emergence of liberalism. And it offers a survey of different women through the 18th and 19th centuries, who waged various protests against these different impositions, like slavery and capitalism and the factories and the enclosure movement before that. So one character it includes is Abigail Adams, who wrote a letter to her husband, John Adams, who, when he was writing the Declaration of Independence, because she was worried that common law was going to form part of, was going to remain a part and parcel of the system in the United States following the Revolution. And she turned out, her fears turned out to be justified. So then it talks about the suffrage movement as well, in various ways that women have resisted their status in the legal system in the West, and resisted chattel marriage and fought for the vote and so forth. But it also talks about women who are closer to my heart politically, like Emma Goldman, who I'm not sure, I don't know that she was against the suffrage movement, but she was definitely I think she thought it was ill-advised to frame the vote as a right if the state is an imposition, because you're basically framing an imposition as a right. And I think she would sooner see the energy invested into suffrage be instead invested into some other way of reclaiming freedom and responsibility from the state, rather than trying to get into, you know, trying to get participation. So my books also offer a way, an overview, by offering a way of seeing like all these different responses to the systems of power that we still live with today. Shall I continue with the last three? I'll try and summarize them.
Yeah, clearly. I think this is great. One of the things I love about this, not only is it a wonderful discussion of history, but this acts as an introduction to all of these great feminist thinkers who've gone before you, and that in itself is I mean, even by itself, that's worth the price of admission.
Yeah, and that's what's made it so wonderful to make. I do think that we're living in a time when there's only particular moments in history that you're supposed to remember. So you get a very narrow idea of, for instance, what it means to be a feminist. And I think I live in a world where it's kind of very much assumed that if you're a feminist, you need to be a reformist, and you need to wear the green, purple, and white banner of the suffragists and be proud of that history. And I am. I think it's amazing. I'm a huge fan of Emmeline Pankhurst. I love her book, My Own Story. But the thing that makes me love the suffragists so much is not actually the reformist objectives that they have. It's actually their spirit and their connection that they had with themselves, with their longings, with their hearts, and their willingness to voice all of that and to stand for all of that. And for me, the question of how to activate that when you have a collective of women is up for discussion. I don't take for granted that suffrage was the only tactic that could have been, you know, the only strategy. So it's wonderful to be able to celebrate all these different women's voices and different women's responses, and then also to be able to explore what they mean for us now and how they open up a discussion about approaches and strategies and priorities.
That's
and
great.
The question of what is freedom, I think, as well. I think one thing that underpins a lot of the differences between them is the way that they conceptualized freedom. And I think that's a really important thing for us all to explore, especially in a day and age where I feel like we're living in the age of appropriation. You might feel the same, Derek. I know, you know, your book, Bright Green Lies, is kind of about the appropriation of the environmentalist movement by, you know, all these reformists and this reformist agenda, which is very much about redeeming the status quo rather than challenging it. And I feel like the same is true for a lot of other social movements. So for me, like, coming back to really essential questions about who am I, what is freedom, what do I believe, is especially important now, which is also another reason why that historic overview is so important, because you can see all these different people asking these questions and drawing different conclusions.
Yeah, for the record, I think that what has happened to environmentalism with its co-optation into serving the system is something that the system does to everything.
Yes.
And there's a couple reasons, I think, for this. One of them is a phrase that someone gave to me years ago called toxic mimic, which is where something takes the form and perverts the content of the thing. And one of the prototypical examples I use of this would be rape, which takes the form of You can either say lovemaking or you can say reproduction, for that matter. You can say, you know, the ultimate creative act, and yeah. And perverts the content entirely into an act of domination and violation.
Yeah.
And then we see it with, you know, the female creator deity, the male creator deity takes the general form of a creator deity and then completely switches the context. And, yeah. You know, we could bring this up to date with, you know, I mean, this happens every day to every single issue. It doesn't matter what it is, whether we're talking about trying to stop racism, you end up with sort of the woke version of racism. And now people are going to get yes. mad at me for that. Or you take some of the modern feminism is actually pretty anti-feminist.
Yeah.
And I should just stop there and let you say it because you're a woman. But yeah, I think this happens not just to the bright green lies. This is just, I think it's to use a cliche from programming, it's a feature, not a bug of patriarchy. And if you want to take that anywhere, just take it anywhere you want.
Yeah. I just completely agree. And that's why, like, I used the phrase the age of appropriation to talk about the day and age that we're living in at the moment. I just feel like, like you say, it's a feature, not a bug, of patriarchy to distort real human longings and real human nature to create these apparent reflections of it. So that people stay kind of hooked in to the status quo. But I just feel like that's happening now at a level that is so insidious, so that it becomes more and more difficult to, like, if you say now that, like, I'm quite cynical about things like the climate strikes, about, you know, just about every, I call these social movements that we're seeing nowadays, pop-up social movements. Like, I haven't been to a march for years. I can't get myself involved in protests where, you know, you basically go for a walk to Parliament and listen to a series of politicians telling you about all the good things that they're doing in the, you know, like, it's just so hollow to me. But I feel like there's such an acceptance of the idea that this is grassroots uprisings happening everywhere, that if you question it, you sound like you're trying to be the uber leftist, you know. You know what I mean? Like, it sounds, so it's quite difficult to communicate that no, this is a really natural response of systems of power to actually recognize and tap into the deepest longings and conscience of humanity, and to try and domesticate that by seeming to cater to it, so that there's no need for us to do that ourselves, you know, by creating real grassroots movements. I think one thing, though, that that makes me, you know, just there's something about the idea that these huge, large-scale social movements can be genuine that to me is just so impossible, because I have experienced personally how difficult it is to create or to sustain solidarity at the grassroots level in this day and age, where people cannot even agree about the reality of biological sex that they see for themselves in the shower every morning. You know, like, if you can't even accept a fact as basic as that between a small group of people, how on earth do you create a global grassroots uprising of any description? So it's so clear to me that these movements are kind of, you know, happening much more because of their huge PR budgets and global franchising than they are because of grassroots solidarity. Like, that's just, to me, it's so clear that it should make people more, you know, suspicious about what's actually being done to the human longing for freedom through these movements. Is it being activated or is it being domesticated? Maybe it's not one or the other, but it's definitely, you know, worth asking questions about.
So thank you for that. And let's move. We've got about we've got about a third of the interview left, and I would like to finish your herstory set to move on also to an essay you recently wrote and give that a little bit of time too. So can we go back to the herstory set?
Yeah, sure. So the last three are called Empire and then Resistance and then Neoliberalism. And the book, which is titled Empire, Book 5, looks at the build-up to the period of the World Wars. So it looks at these various European empires competing for territory and capital. And that looks at that as the build-up to the World Wars. And it also talks about eugenics and the nature of eugenics. So I've been asked who's my target audience for these books. And I always say 17 plus now, because some of these topics are really difficult and disturbing. And that book is the most difficult. And then it ends with talking about Simone de Beauvoir and how her book The Second Sex challenged the notions of femininity that are part and parcel of any eugenics model. We have this idealized image of a woman, and a woman as a sex object and a woman as a breeder. And so she writes her book, The Second Sex. But in Simone de Beauvoir's lifetime, Simone, from what I understand, she also moved from prioritizing socialism to feminism. So at some point, she still believed that in order for women to be free, they would first have to have economic equality, which is only attainable through a socialist or a workers' movement. But later on, she changed her mind. And then book 6 of my series is kind of an exploration of how many women did the same thing, went through the same thing. So book 6, Resistance, is about the many independence movements and leftist movements of the 19th and 20th centuries. And specifically, it is about women's experience of those and women's critiques of those as being male-dominated. And that book is kind of an alternative history of the emergence of the women's liberation movement of the 70s and 80s. It takes a global view and says, you know, that this was a global phenomenon where women were coming together and saying, hey, all these leftist movements are very male-dominated. And gradually, this is a process of consciousness raising about this, as well as, you know, domestic sexism and other forms of sexism and rape, gives rise to a global women's liberation movement. And then the last book, book 7, is about neoliberalism as a backlash to all of these radical and leftist and women's movements of the previous centuries, decades. So it talks about how neoliberalism was an effort to push back against all the progress that had been made, privatize lands that hadn't yet been taken through colonization. Roll back legislation and protections that had been established for workers and that were restricting corporate profiteering, and force governments to reduce, you know, public spending on health, education, welfare. So that book also talks about what impact this had on women, how the disposition of women through neoliberalism led to was how prostitution, the sex trade, benefited from that, because so many women ended up in poverty and desperation and were then preyed on by pimps. how this led to the growth of the porn industry, and how the porn industry and how all of these factors are contributing to a culture of dissociation, where people are so disconnected from our bodies through the combined trauma of disconnection from the land, of epidemic rape, and of the promotion of pervasive promotion of rape through porn and objectification, that the state of dissociation that is prevalent in the culture now is so prevalent and profound that allows for transgenderism to enter the scene, and it creates a precondition in terms of psychological preconditions for accepting the idea that you are not your body, and that you know your body can have a sex but your identity can have a different one, and so forth, like this kind of split, this kind of fragmented idea of who we are. So I only talk about transgenderism briefly in that book, but yeah, that is really where the series ends.
A couple of things. One of them is that this notion that we aren't our body, I think, is central to everything that you've been talking about in this herstory, and is central to everything in patriarchy. And it's also, you know, the same is true. And it's part of the reason this culture is killing the planet, is because this is not our real home. Our real home is heaven somewhere else. And, you know, this is not, again, this is the notion that I am my mind, which is above my body and separate from my body, is just the same dualism that you were hitting in book three.
Yeah. So the whole series kind of does provide context for understanding, some of the most bizarre ideological propositions of our day and age, because I think they need that much context. Like, I get quite personally frustrated when I see phenomena like transgenderism being understood as a kind of legislative threat, like we have to stop this particular law from going through, or being argued with as though it has any validity. Like, oh, we need to remind people about what testosterone is, and, you know, like, we need to re-educate people about the existence of biological sex. And to me, that's a really common response to recognizing, you know, something like transgenderism. But it actually doesn't account for what it takes for a human being to be in such deep denial about their, you know, who we are and what our nature is. Like, you can't argue with that level of denial. So it pays actually to get an understanding of where it, what it's rooted in and where it comes from, in order to decide how you are going to respond to it. And I'm so much craving responses that have that kind of depth to them, where people are really trying to grapple with what is going on with the human species right now, rather than simply react to it, or, you know, that this series is a contribution to that desire for a really deep-seated form of individual and collective response to the realities of today.
Well, and you know, I was realizing as you were going through, and you've done a wonderful job here so far, I was realizing that my request for you was really unfair to ask you, and effectively what I did is ask you to summarize the entire herstory from the Big Bang to the present in 45 to 48 minutes.
And that's okay.
I may as well, if he were still alive, I may as well just call up Edward Gibbon and say, tell me about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire in 45 to 48 minutes, except that you've got, you know, a million times longer time scale. It'd be, or what's that old joke about I read War and Peace in a half an hour. It's about Russia. it's the same thing here that I've asked you to summarize the history of the universe from a feminist perspective. But anyway, you've done a great job. So I just wanted to acknowledge publicly how unfair I have been today. So having said that, we have about 10 minutes left. So can you wrote this really extraordinary essay recently, and now I'm going to ask you to summarize this. Yeah, summarize it in 3 seconds. It's called On Enclosure and Its New Frontiers. Is there a limit to what can be privatized? So you got like 10 minutes. So can you spend 6 or 7 minutes talking about it and pointing people toward the ideas? I mean, because that's really, you know, I'm making jokes about this, but really what you've done, I think, is just, like I said, introduce people to, you know, come read my books, yes, but then what you really need to do, look at Merlin Stone, look at Marilyn French, look at, you know, all these other writers to get the real in-depth version. So give us the cliff notes of this essay and then tell people how they can learn more about it.
Sure. So, well, thankfully I've already done most of the work, because the essay really does distill the continuous the books that I've written, but to make a more specific argument or statement about the world we live in today. So what I did with that essay is I talked about this phenomenon called enclosure, in order to talk about in order to propose that we're currently living in a world where this phenomenon of enclosure is still taking place, and we need to look at it that way. And what I mean by enclosure is I'm going back to the beginnings of modern capitalism, at the time in England where the commons, which were lands that peasants were able to freely roam and access and use for foraging, for medicinal and edible plants, and for wood, for fires, and just to be on the land. So these common lands were privatized in the Tudor period, and then used for like grazing sheep, for the wool, for the textile industry. I feel like it's useful to look at that as, I mean, it's sort of, you can't really say that's the beginning, and, you know, there's a history before that as well. But if you look at that as the beginning of a trend, and then say that disconnection from the land is what created so much poverty and dispossession, along with the fact that the Tudors also took all the church property, because they were Protestants, they broke from Rome, and the church had previously helped people in poverty. So there was no assistance for the poor, and there was no common lands, and so people became very desperate. And then you have the Industrial Revolution, people having to accept jobs in factories where you're working conditions are absolutely abysmal. And then you have the growth of this union movement. But then, of course, this phenomenon of enclosure has also affected the union movement. It's come and in various ways over the last, 100 years or more, the unions have kind of been broken or assimilated, or, there's been attempts to absorb them back into the system, back into the establishment. So there's this enclosure phenomenon that has moved from the lands to the unions. And I feel like then, it has also, when I look at a movement like transgenderism, I see that same thing happening, but with sex and sexuality, that now our sexuality is being privatized. Like, that's what's happened through the growth of the sex trade under neoliberalism. And then you know, as a result
of
that.
Wait. Can you explain that? I don't understand what you mean by sex is privatized.
So just that prostitution itself is a commodification of human sexuality. It turns it into something that you can supposedly buy access to women. Or maybe you could better say that women are commodified and privatized, or there's an attempt to do so through the promotion of prostitution as something legitimate and something you can, you know, you can buy women, you can buy sex. And then as that has, I mean, there's been this massive growth in the promotion of prostitution as legitimate post-neoliberalism or in the neoliberal age. And then, as I mentioned before, that this has led to the growth of porn, this has led to more pervasive states of dissociation that have allowed for the rise of transgenderism, which is the next level of enclosure, which is the enclosure of biology itself. Now people, you know, just... it's like your biological sex is no longer a natural fact. It's an identity that you need to purchase things to express, like, you know, express your gender identity by dyeing your hair green and, like, you know, if you're a man, like, wear women's clothing to communicate that you're feminine or whatever. Like, so, you know, this is kind of like a commodification of biology, of sex itself. And then now we're living in an age where everyone's stuck on their smartphones. I talk about this in book 7 as well, Shoshana Zuboff's book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, where, you know, data is the new oil. So we're all plugged into our phones, and that has caused me to ask myself the question of what is the nature of this phase of enclosure. And when I ask myself that, I kind of reach the conclusion that there's an attempt to privatize human sensitivity, which is quite a scary thing. Like, so we're becoming more and more sensitive to all the things that are going on our phones and its notifications, and we're becoming more and more numb to the world, the natural world that we've been, you know, slowly disconnected from over the centuries more and more and more. And so that's led me to the conclusion that the reclamation of the human heart and human sensitivity is of primary importance in this day and age. And I think as well that that effort is going to be what allows us to create social movements which are no longer compromised and appropriated and you know, reformist at base, but instead that grow out of the human soul. It's really time for us to go there, because I think we have no other choice at this point. So that's,
Wait. What is it that will allow us to create these social movements?
I really reached the conclusion that the thing that is being threatened at the moment is the sensitivity of the human being, of the human body, of the living organism, that this sensitivity is appropriated through technology at the moment and all its, you know, an AI, like the ultra sensitivity of technology is in some sense trying to substitute or replace for the sensitivity of human life, which I talk about in book 1 of my series. I draw on the work of Stephen Buhner, who talks about the heart as an organ of perception and a sensitive organ rather than just a muscular pump, as you would understand it in a dualistic, reductive Western medical framework. So he taught me a lot about the human heart as the seat of sensitivity. And I, you know, when I look around at what is my issue as well with a lot of the kind of co-opted and appropriated social movements that I'm seeing, it is precisely that disconnection from the raw longings and voice of the human heart. And so that's why I feel like, you know, the very thing that I believe is under threat at the moment, reconnecting with that is the thing that's going to reinvigorate a lot of the other work that we're trying to do.
Well, thank you for that. I think that's really, really important. So before we close, can you tell people how they can, sorry to be so crass, but how they can buy or otherwise access your Brief Complete Herstory full set?
Yes. So my publishing brand is called Dragon Cloud Press. And my website is dragoncloudpress.com. So you can find all the books there.
And is there anything else available to store, or is that it?
There's some postcards as well. but yeah.
So just to be clear, you both wrote and illustrated this.
Yes, I did.
Okay, so is there any final thing you would like to say on that new series?
No, it's been a real labor of love, and I've got a lot out of reading all the books that enabled me to put this narrative together, and I really hope to share that, and I also really appreciate the support of people who have bought my book so far. So thank you so much for that. And I hope I can send more out into the world.
Well, I think it's a really important set, and I think it's just a fascinating is too weak. Important is too stodgy. It's I think it's a really crucial work. I'll say that. And so thank you again for being on the program, and thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Renee Gerlich. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.